chaos. The story of how it all began, from the creation of the cosmos out of chaos to the birth of the primordial deities. These days, the origin of the universe is explained by proposing a Big Bang, a single event that instantly brought into being all the matter from which everything and everyone are made. The ancient Greeks had a different idea. They said it all started not with a bang, but with chaos. Think of chaos, perhaps as a kind of grand cosmic yawn. As in a yawning chasm, or a yawning void, that began the long chain of creation, that has ended with pelicans and penicillin, and toadstools and toads, sea lions, seals, lions, human beings, and daffodils, and murder, and art, and love, and confusion, and death, and madness, and biscuits. Whatever the truth, science today agrees that everything is destined to return to chaos. It calls this inevitable fate entropy, part of the great cycle from chaos to order and back again to chaos. So the chaos that began everything is also the chaos that will end everything. From formless chaos sprang two creations, Erebus and Nyx. Erebus, he was darkness, and Nyx, she was night. They coupled at once, and the flashing fruits of their union were Hemera, day, and Aether, light. At the same time, because everything must happen simultaneously until time is there to separate events, chaos brought forth two more entities, Gaia, the earth, and Tartarus, the depths and caves beneath the earth. These were the primordial deities, the first order of divine beings, from whom all the gods, heroes, and monsters of Greek myth spring. They brooded over and lay beneath everything, waiting. The silent emptiness of this world was filled when Gaia bore two sons, all on her own. The first was Pontus, the sea. Rhea. Rhea is one of the 12 Titans, children of Uranos and Gaia. She was instrumental in helping her beloved brother Kronos overthrow Uranos and rule all creation from Mount Othrys. As we shall see, her love soon has cause to turn to fear, dread, and hatred. When he arrived on Mount Othrys, Kronos found his sister Rhea waiting for him. The sight of her darkly handsome brother, a huge sickle dripping blood in his hand, thrilled her to the point of internal explosion. His authority was established. None of his brother or sister Titans dared question him. His father was powerless, and Gaia, who found she could take no joy in the violent overthrow she had set in motion, withdrew into her realm and into a more passive existence. She never lost her strength, authority, or high status as Mother Earth and ancestress of all, but she no longer ventured forth to interact or conjoin. Kronos was the master now. After a great feast in which his achievement in unmanning and unseating Uranos was roaringly and most unmusically sung, Kronos turned to the blushing, trembling Rhea and pulled her aside to make love to her. Rhea's joy was complete. She had played her part in helping the brother she adored achieve mastery of all creation. And now they were united. More than that, in the fullness of time, she began to feel a child moving inside her. A baby girl, she felt sure. Her happiness was unclouded. Kronos, on the other hand, his already dour disposition was darkened by something else. The words of his father Uranos began to echo in his head. Your own children will overthrow you as you overthrew me. Over the coming weeks and months, Kronos watched with sullen foreboding as Rhea's belly filled and swelled. Your own. Persephone and the Chariot. When Greek children asked how it was that they went through four seasons, from winter through spring to summer, and then autumn and winter again, their parents were able to explain it by telling them this story of the beautiful Persephone and how she was seized by a dark and powerful god. The world over which Zeus ruled as sovereign lord of heaven was a bountiful mother to mankind. Men, women, and children helped themselves to the fruit of the trees, the grains of the grasses, the fish of the waters, and the beasts of the fields without effort or much labor. Demeter, goddess of fertility and the harvest, blessed the natural world. Demeter had a daughter, Persephone, by her brother Zeus. So beautiful and pure and lovely was she that the gods took to calling her Kore, or Cora, which means simply the maiden. The Romans called her Proserpina. All the gods, especially the unattached Apollo and Hermes, fell dizzily in love with her and even offered marriage. But the protective, some might say overprotective, Demeter hid her away in the remote countryside, far from the hungry eyes of the gods and immortals, honorable and dishonorable alike, intending for her to remain, like Hestia, Athena, and Artemis, forever virgin and unattached. There was one powerful god, however, who had laid his covetous eyes upon the girl and had no intention of respecting Demeter's wishes. There was nothing the sweet and artless Persephone liked to do more than commune with nature. Very much her mother's daughter, flowers and pretty growing things were her greatest source of joy. One golden afternoon, a little separated from the companions appointed by her mother to protect her, Persephone was chasing butterflies as they flitted from blossom to blossom in a sun-dappled, flowery meadow. Suddenly, she heard a deep rending and roaring sound. It was like thunder, yet seemed to be coming not from the sky above, but from the ground beneath her feet. She looked about her in fear and bewilderment. Thank you. Apollo and Marsyas. If the Greek myths agree about one thing, it is the foolish recklessness of challenging the gods. Arachne thought she was a better weaver than the goddess Athene and was turned into a spider for her impudence. Few were punished as severely as the satyr Marsyas, whose story should be a warning to us all. Mortal humans were not the only beings capable of exhibiting excessive pride. The goddess Athena's injured self-regard led, indirectly, to the downfall of a conceited satyr called Marsyas. It all began when Athena proudly invented a new musical instrument, which she named the aulos. There was one problem with this splendid instrument. Whenever Athena played it, gorgeous as the music that emerged undoubtedly was, it elicited from her fellow Olympians nothing but roars of laughter. There was no way for Athena to get a good sound from it without blowing so hard that her cheeks bulged. To see this goddess, the very personification of dignity, going all pink and swelling up like a bullfrog, was more than her disrespectful family could take without howling out loud. Wise as Athena was, and free, for the most part, of affectation and conceit, she was not entirely without vanity and could not bear to be mocked. After 3 attempts to win the gods over with the mellifluous sounds of her new instrument, she cursed it and cast it down from Olympus. The aulos fell to earth in Asia Minor, in the kingdom of Phrygia, near the source of the Meander River, whose winding course lends its name to all mazy wandering streams, where it was picked up by a satyr called Marsyas. As a follower of Dionysus, Marsyas was gifted with curiosity, as well as many more disreputable traits. He dusted the aulos off and blew into it. A small peep was the only result. He laughed and scratched at the tickling buzz in his lips. He puffed and blew hard again until a long, loud, musical note was produced. This was fun. He went on his way, blowing and blowing until he could, after a surprisingly short time, play a real tune. Thank you. Sisyphus. How the gods loved to punish mortal presumption. And few mortals were ever as presumptuous as Sisyphus, king of Corinth. He had already cheated Thanatos, the god of death, once, and he was to astound the world by dreaming up a plan to cheat death a second time. For his plan to work, he would need the cooperation of his new wife. In the town villa in which he had made temporary lodging, Sisyphus addressed his wife. His new young queen was as kindly and obedient as Tyro had been willful and contrary. "My dear," he said, drawing her to him, "I feel that soon I shall die. When I have breathed my last and my soul has fled, what will you do?" "I will do what must be done, my lord. I will wash and anoint you. I will place an obolus on your tongue so that you might pay the ferryman. We will stand guard 7 days and 7 nights over your catafalque. Burnt offerings will be sent up to please the king and queen of the underworld. And in this way, your journey to the meadows of Asphodel shall be a blessed one."
"You mean well, but that is exactly what you must not do," said Sisyphus. "The moment I am dead, I want you to strip me naked and have me thrown into the street."
"My lord, I'm quite serious."
"Deadly serious. This is my desire, my entreaty, my command. No matter what anyone else says, you will send up no prayers, make no sacrifices, perform no obsequies. Treat my remains as you would those of a dog. Promise me that."
"But..."
Sisyphus took her by the shoulders and looked deep into her eyes to reinforce the earnestness of his commands. "As you love me and are bound to me, as you hope never to be haunted by my angry shade, promise to do exactly as I have said. Swear it on your soul."
I swear it."
"It is good. Now, let us drink. A toast to life." His timing, as ever, was impeccable, for that very evening, Sisyphus was awoken by the whisper of Thanatos, god of death, at his bedside. "Your time is come, Sisyphus of Corinth." The manacles were attached, and the pair glided down to the mouth of the underworld.